What is good, everybody, and welcome back to Party Chat, the companion show to the Dualcom podcast. If you missed the first episode, a few bits of housekeeping. All of the episodes are available on your favorite podcast services. Epos put in the time, saw the feedback, so subscribe to us wherever you like to listen to podcasts. How have you been, Epos? How's your week?
I am doing pretty good. Kiddo's finally back in school. I am going on the first field trip tomorrow, so that's something. And been playing the heck out of my Game Boy.
What are you playing on that?
Mostly Pokemon. I reached in-game Elite Four stuff on Pokemon Emerald, a save that I had started in, I want to say, 2023, and had just been playing off and on, and then fired up a new Emerald save, or sorry, a new Ruby save, and almost to the end game already. Got like 20 hours in on that one. It is super easy to squeeze in hours when you're just have a handheld in between things, and I know that it will be fleeting, but my current obsession has me on the 100% completion rabbit hole, so I've been building up my collection of like the Japanese games and the GameCube games and getting everything together, because you gotta own like at least 7 different games and a bunch of cables and at least 4 different handhelds to actually complete your Pokedex in these games, so it's so exploitative.
Yeah, those cross energy things are kind of cool, though. I mean, if you are a completionist, it's horrible. I'm not. You know, I don't have to have everything, but there were some really weird tie-ins back then, weren't there?
Yes. It's a lot of fun, though. It is something that, like, posted a picture the other day where, like, I feel like I had the idyllic, like, 2000s evening, because I was just sitting there frying up some, I do a 2-stage fry for chicken drumsticks on the stove. So I had them doing the stage one. I had house DVDs playing on my CRT on the counter, and I was playing my Game Boy. No internet, no anything, just in my zone, watching house, playing Pokemon, living the life.
That sounds incredible. I'm quite jealous. I've got my retro gear here. I picked up a Casio F91W watch because I've wanted to get away from looking at my phone screen to tell the time. And I won't lie, within literally the first 2 hours of wearing the thing, it was really nice to be like, no notifications, no work emails showing up on the screen. I can tell you right now, we're recording this at 8:18 Wednesday morning. And speaking of that, the PlayStation Store is having a pretty good sale called the Player's Choice Sale until October 22nd. All digital, but a lot of pretty sick deals for PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 5 games. So worthwhile if that's somebody's like main ecosystem to check out.
Yeah, for sure. Mass Effect was like $6. Like, really good sales. And digital's fine. We got, not in this show, but I think we're going to have a conversation about the PS4 soon. I think it's time.
It's a good system. That's actually what I played this last week. Yeah. I reinstalled the Wipeout Omega Collection. Nice. I have played some Ace Combat 7. I got an indie skateboard game called Ollie World for $5 looking at for a long time.
I think I got that as a PS Plus thing. I played it a little bit. It was fun.
Yeah, very fun. I'm looking for those good session games. Yeah. This will be like a side tangent, then we can get into it. But a lot of times those indie games, I think, miss how quickly to get you into the action. They've got enough depth to them to where it just takes forever to get up to speed, and that's how I kind of felt with Ollie World so far. Like, a really cool concept, but I kind of wish it would just throw me in the deep end. Yeah. Here's the screen on what to do and figure it out. But
for sure.
Anyway, neither here nor there. We have a lot of comments, and we didn't even finish all the comments last time. So quick recap, if it's your first time listening to the show, we on the Dual Commentary podcast get tons of great feedback and comments from you. We want to read, respond, and talk about some of the ideas that you put out there. So this is that show. Party Chat is exactly there. So why don't we begin, Epos, where we left off last time. What's our first comment?
We've got a back-to-back double set of comments from Pocket Wyvern 98. The first one is, there's something I've been wondering if you two might have some thoughts on. How do you feel about situations where you still love a franchise as a whole, but not the current output? When it feels important to you, but it doesn't feel like it is for you anymore, I don't even know if I could keep on one hand the number of franchises that this has happened to me with. And I know you have quite a few as well. This is very near and dear to our hearts in the year 2025.
It's hard. I mean, there's a lot of emotions about this specific topic. Halo will be mine. What would be your main one? Halo as well for you, I know.
Yeah, Halo, Pokemon, specific, since I'm playing it right now, like I have very confined bounds on what Pokemon games I can I play, and as much FOMO as I have been experiencing for the new one about to come out, they have announced a few quote-unquote features that are actually making sure that I am definitely not buying it anytime soon because of the decisions being made. So definitely Pokemon's a huge one, especially because it's been going my entire life. Like, one of my very first games was a Pokemon game, and they're just, it's not for me at the moment. Dragon Age, probably Mass Effect soon.
That's a good one. Yeah. Andromeda, I tried a little bit of and could just tell this isn't the vibe for me.
The biggest thing for me is to just accept things as they are. Like, games are a product, but they're also just, they are a form of art. And art is made for the artist, not always for the audience. And I know as we get into modern games, that definitely changes. But, you know, art is made for the artist, not for the person consuming it. And sometimes that means it doesn't hit you the same way. And sometimes that means that you don't always pick up on the right messaging, but you can still have a little fun with it. Or sometimes it means you just don't play it anymore. Like with Dragon Age specifically, I have played 1 and 2. I think I put a little teeny tiny bit of time into Inquisition when it came out. I'm working on my new, you know, playing through all the games still. I've been talking about it on our podcast back and forth. And the big issue, like my wife has basically written off Veilguard. My wife's been a huge Dragon Age fan and just kind of wrote it off right away. Like all the things you hear about it, it's like, yep, this is not a Dragon Age game. But I am someone who doesn't have quite as strong of an attachment to it overall. I still had my mind absolutely blown by Origins and playing through it and seeing the depth and the writing and the darkness in it. Incredible stuff. But then going, knowing what 2 has, I'm not on 2 in my new playthrough, but I played it back in like 2015. 2 is immediately a more shallow game. It's not as shallow as the newer one sounds like, but it's still a much more shallow game, immediately trying to appeal to the 2010s era console market, whereas the first Dragon Age game was a very hardcore PC game. And then it changed again with Inquisition and again with Veilguard. Like, a lot of games have their identity really shift every game. I felt the same. I think I just talked about it last podcast episode about Mass Effect. Whereas for me, the identity of Mass Effect drastically shifted from 1 to 2. And immediately I'm like, this is not the same game. And there's still lots to love about it. Still a great game. But like, a lot of the things that I loved about what made Mass Effect 1 Mass Effect is not there in 2. And so with games like that, I find it easy to kind of zoom out and take that perspective of like, okay, it's always shifting and you just kind of got to roll with the identity. But then we have games like Pokemon or Halo where the identity was very strong and consistent for a significant part of our time with it. And then it shifts. And that feels more like a rug pull. That feels more like a, oh no, something's happening, something's wrong. And that's harder to deal with. And so for me, my choice is to either vote with my wallet by just not participating or at least doing so on a very delayed method. I may eventually get that new Pokemon game, but I am not going to do it until I have a Switch 2. And I have no reason to have a Switch 2 anytime soon. And I'm definitely not going to do it on launch because they keep releasing busted Pokemon games on launch and I don't want to encourage that. My voice means nothing in the sea of Pokemania that has resurged in the past few years, but for my own sanity, I kind of have to make that choice. With Halo, yeah, I'm just like, all right, Halo's probably dead, but I'm just going to be along for the ride because I love it so dearly. Like, Halo 5 is arguably my least favorite game in any franchise I've played more than one game of ever. And I can still, like, I'm probably going to go back and play it soon. It's been like 10 years. I'm going to go play it. Like, I can at least just be like, yep, that's not what I wanted, but it's Halo. And if I want more Halo, I will play it. So that's like the 3 strategies, I guess, I take, depending on my investment level, my sentimentality, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, this one's really hard. I don't have a definitive answer because, like, the emotions never go away. Like, growing up, big reason why I still game is Halo 1, 2, and 3, and the memories of playing Halo 2 multiplayer on the couch with my good friend online with Xbox Live, and then Halo 3, and pretty much most of my online friendships, like, started in the Halo era from Halo 3 and Halo 2, and I think it's okay to be cautious to not associate your identity with a franchise.
Yeah,
you can like games within that franchise, you can like eras within it, but if you get too wrapped up emotionally, you can become eternally negative and cynical over something you have virtually no control over. And I think that's the hard part, is everybody now has the megaphone to yell online and press the dislike button and do all these things that feel like you're moving the needle, and hopefully the franchise will like listen to the core fan base. But at the end of the day, if you don't want to just be miserable all the time, you kind of have to just celebrate the good times, remember them fondly, participate if you still can.
Yeah.
But then also be comfortable adapting and moving on is the only way I can say it. Because like with Halo, I love that franchise too, dude. But I have been disappointed from Halo 4 onward. And I've tried, there's like a full decade of the channel where it's that goal of trying to spread the message and be like, man, this is what it needs. This is all it needs. And it's so close. If they could just figure this out, have a content-packed launch, all of those things, it would be great again. But I'm telling you, it doesn't make a difference.
No.
Maybe it does with some mid-level devs, but the people who actually make the big sweeping decisions, the C-suite, like leadership stuff, their decisions are motivated not by fan sentiment for the most part.
Like, yeah.
Especially if you're a part of a franchise where it gets inherited by a new leadership or a new team or another team or whatever. It's up to the objectives. If they're going to prioritize a new fan base versus the old fan base, you can see it in films. There's like the Star Wars fandom, right? A whole crazy world of people so super frustrated. I don't like the new movies that they made. I love 4, 5, 6 and the prequels. Some of my favorite films of all time. And I just am not going to get a pitchfork out or give a rip. I can be disappointed if it's going in the wrong direction, but my energy, especially my emotional energy, is better directed elsewhere. And I think that's the only thing to say on it, is your time is precious and your energy is precious, and you should not waste it on such a fruitless thing as being angry or upset about the direction of a franchise. If you can voice yourself in a constructive way, go for it.
Yeah.
But don't take up arms over it, you know?
Yeah. It's human to be disappointed, maybe even a little hurt if it's that sentimental and they've really done something with it. But then, yeah, you have to move on. And the big thing, like, no one can take away the memories and the experiences you had with the originals, the games that you did like, whatever entry it was that was your favorite. No one can steal that from you. And in many cases, they can't, especially if it's an older game, they can't take the original games away from you in the first place. You can still get more value out of them. I'm going to continue playing the first 3, 4, 5, even 6 generations of Pokemon for my entire life. They are games that I can endlessly repeat, go back to, find new ways to play, find new ways to enjoy, squeeze my love out of, and continue to... It won't be the same as playing them the first time, but I can still enjoy them. With Halo, I can go back and play the campaigns. I can invite people to play co-op with me if they want to. We have MCC still at the moment for enjoying a somewhat faithful recreation of the original. Obviously, matchmaking's a little not right anymore with how limited the player base is, but like MCC holds up pretty strongly in terms of being able to easily just jump in and play Halo. I can still, it is janky and broken, but I can still go back and play Dragon Age Origins. Like, you haven't lost anything by the new games being bad. You're just not getting anything new from it. And with every genre out there, there are new games taking up the mantle. There are new developers being like, hey, I missed this. I'm going to make something there. So whether it's an ARPG like Dragon Age, whether it's a first-person shooter, that market's a little messy, but there's still some love there. We actually got a comment that I didn't screenshot for this, but asking if we've played RoboQuest, which is apparently a shooter that is fun. I haven't actually looked at it yet, but you know, there's at least something. Multiplayer gets a little funky, but in terms of single player, if you want Pokemon likes, you can either play the originals because they're endless hours to get out of it. You can play ROM hacks, which are community made games, some of which are incredible that you can get infinite hours out of, or there are alternatives to Pokemon these days. If you just like the gameplay mechanics, there's Temtem, there's Nexomon, there's the new Digimon Survival, or not Survival, Digimon World game. There are other things, and you just have to open your mind. Like, either you can get stuck only wanting this thing, and that's kind of the problem of sequels in the first place, is you dig your heels in and get really stubborn, expecting only the game that you played the first time, and then it's going to be different, and then that doesn't meet your expectations. Or you can open your mind a little bit and know that, hey, I'm going to get something similar, and there's probably a lot to love here as long as I expand my horizons a little bit.
Well said. Well said. Do you want to do the follow-up comment from Wyvern?
We got a second comment from Wyvern. I think these were on completely separate episodes. I just want to put them together because it's cool getting multiple from the same person. I'm getting kind of fed up with the consumerist aspects of the hobby, the pressure to buy new games and new hardware. I feel like this feeds into the first question that they asked. How do you manage or how do you navigate this aspect of the hobby while staying intentional and not getting stuck living in the past? So, yeah, that connects to the first one. Wanted to keep them together. For me, ditching multiplayer, I think, for both of us was a huge benefit to that because there's not really FOMO to be had with new single-player games. Like, right now, everyone's talking about how successful Ghost of Yotai is. I'm very excited for it. I want to jump in, but I'm still in my Ghost of Tsushima playthrough. There is no point into me spending 60, 70, 80 bucks on this game right now that I'm not going to play for 6 months to a year. So I take that energy, put my head in the sand and go play the original. And then when I'm done with that, it's probably going to be on sale and I can pick it up cheaper and then get the game. For single player games, for session games, there's no FOMO to be had. If there's a new game, sure, add it to a wish list, make a spreadsheet, add it to something so you can keep track of it. But then you don't need to buy it right away.
Discipline and momentum are the words that come to mind. You can take out a piece of paper right now and write down 3 to 5 games in your backlog that you want to play, beat, replay, whatever. And stick to that and start knocking them off. And you begin to build this momentum. And I will tell you, there's a joy in it that once you've started to do that process of just playing what you already have, you'll realize pretty quickly that the $70 and $80 new release is not that pulling. It's not much of a draw anymore. And like you said, on the single player side, you only benefit from waiting. So unless in your social circle, you just can't wait to like see a film on opening night, which I get that hype for sure, don't want something spoiled, whatever. But those would be the periphery things. Those are going to be the outliers, right? So if you can be a little disciplined and just say, I bet everybody listening to this podcast, if they've been gaming for a while, has at least 3 to 5 games that they know they want to beat for the first time or replay, do that. Don't buy something new. Even if you just go back and play 1 or 2 games, right? That can make an enormous difference. And then it's very easy, like you said, to fall out of the FOMO loop. If you're on the multiplayer side, it's kind of tricky though.
Yeah.
There are only certain moments of discovery where experience a Call of Duty for the first few months is radically different than a year later once everybody's figured it out. Or a game like Halo MCC, yeah, multiplayer's there, but population's just gone. It's just the diehards who remain. So if you want to go play it, prepare to get slapped around quite a bit. It's going to be people who are really dedicated to that hobby. So there is some benefit on the multiplayer with the initial side, but I don't really play it anymore, so I'm not going to comment too deeply. But that's I get tired of the FOMO too, dude. You're not alone. I don't have it figured out. I'm not... there is always the draw of like, oh, well, that looks cool.
Yeah.
My issue is anytime there's a sale like going on right now, I start looking at things and building a checklist of games. And it's like, no, stop, dude. Right. Stop.
I think.
Hold up.
Yeah. I think the quote we've said a couple times about sitting down and thinking, are you buying the thing that you're going to play for the next week, month, year? Or are you buying the idea that you're going to have time to buy games? Because for like Steam sales and PlayStation sales and stuff, it is so easy for me to rack up a massive cart of like all these games that look like a lot of fun. But then I have to sit there and be like, when am I going to play them?
Yeah.
I have so many games I haven't played, with the main bottleneck there being time. Like, it's not that I don't want to play these games. It's not like I just am not in the mood for them. I just do not have infinite time to sit here and play them. So why would I keep expanding that backlog?
Because it's easy when you're like surfing the web to buy a game.
It's so easy to buy.
That's how
now
you periphery participate in the hobby, right? It's just, but it's hard. It's you're buying the commitment or guilt.
Yeah. And if we want to talk about like the consumer side and the low friction to buy stuff, especially with hardware, I'm going to loop in another comment about the Switch 2, but specifically call out that this morning I put in an order for a new hardware that I probably shouldn't have, but I've been very excited for it. It is the Ain Thor. It is a custom handheld that is basically an OLED 3DS. So it's got the dual screens. It's got the 3DS button, joystick, D-pad layout, but the screens are OLED. And it's set up so that you can emulate DS and 3DS games on the most beautiful screens on powerful hardware. I don't need this. I just talked about how I'm set up with all of my actual Game Boys and DSs and whatever. But there are things that I want to do with regards to, like, there are a lot of mods now for the DS Pokemon games where you can unlock the resolution.
Yeah, see, that's what I was about to say. You are absolutely in the Pokemon universe.
Yeah.
Like, you're beating games, you're loving it, you're playing it. If you bought a used 3DS, it's more expensive than this on eBay.
It is expensive. The one I got was $350, and then I got some accessories with it. Like, that's expensive, but, yeah, if you look at the 3DS market right now, it is very expensive. I was just pricing out. I wanted to get one of those modded up Game Boy Advances with like the LEDs, the HDMI mod, all that. And when I put all the mods together, it was about $500 for a console that you could buy for $60 20 years ago. This is cheaper than that with fancier screens and stuff. So like, you got to really evaluate what you're going to use and why you're going to use it. There's a lot of mods for those Pokemon games to like up the resolution. I can do ROM hacks. I can add in custom stuff. Like, there's stuff I've been wanting to do that I do not want to sit at a PC to do it. And so this seems like the perfect thing. But it was just low enough, and they had a clear purple one, which is I'm always a sucker for. Translucent purple cases on electronics is just, like, so easy. But, you know, there was low enough friction that I was able to just impulse buy it when maybe I shouldn't have, but I at least evaluated because I was already weighing my options there. I evaluated what I was actually going to use the most, and this sounded like the cool next step. Plus, I obviously get to make videos on it and, you know, milk it for that. So I just bought that. So then I want to reference this comment that I think you screenshotted from Straw Hat Monty 22897 that says, y'all talk the crap out of PC handhelds, but can't get down with the Switch 2 price. It seems hypocritical to me. But regardless, other than my disagreements when y'all talk about Switch 2, Switch 1, and some other stray things, I disagree with regarding the industry. I like these. I will say backwards compatibility on Switch 2 makes the $450 worth it to play Switch 1 games at an acceptable frame rate. For the backlog, Switch 2 is great because you're going through your existing Switch 1 backlog, but they run better. So I wanted to talk about that kind of decision because it's not just about the price with these things. It's not just about the raw value because we did address last episode that you and I like to keep our consoles. We don't want to just trade it in and swap it out. We like to keep what we have. But also, the price was kind of the Switch 2 was an indicator of other things, of the higher game prices, the higher accessory prices, and the lack of value up front. To me, on principle, and I'm going to sound like a total hypocrite saying this with the handheld, which is why I wanted to call out the like incongruence here, buying a new system purely on the basis of then being able to play the older system's games at a better performance is not selling me anything personally. I don't know about you, but like that's not why I buy consoles.
I see, but that's a desire for me, like higher frame rate for Breath of the Wild, Tears, Link's Awakening, Echoes of Wisdom. That does make sense to me. I think like my summary is Switch 2 at $400 is probably the price point where I'm like, cool.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's just I liked Nintendo a ton during the Wii era where they were the affordable option along with, yeah, their software doesn't get discounts, but they're always fantastic on the first party side. But $450 for the base console, $80 for the premium games, $90 for the new Switch 2 Pro controller. Like, it seemed like a lot, but probably not in this astronomical place that Straw Hat is referring to. The screen is kind of lackluster on Switch 2, but I mean, here's... Like, if you're enjoying the system, who cares what anybody else thinks?
Yeah, hat? For sure.
Like, if you like it, I totally see the value there. If you get a big Switch 1 library and that's your ecosystem, sweet, be pumped. But don't worry about changing anybody else's opinion online. Like, that'll just be, there's always going to be people on the other side of the argument. And it's like a huge bummer if the energy is spent trying to win them over just enjoy, you know?
Yeah. Like what I and we have described about our personal choices here with buying stuff, like that is where our current priorities and values are. There are a lot of people, like I'm assuming Straw Hat, that play the crap out of their Switch and are excited to just extend that. And that's perfect. That's the idea of the handheld that I just ordered was I play the crap out of my Game Boys and DSs and I want a beefier one where I can do more stuff. For me, I'm not a big Switch person. Like I bought it for Pokemon. Pokemon was devastatingly disappointing on the Switch. I have played a couple of the other games, but I still haven't even played Breath of the Wild in the first place. And I know you said, you know, it is appealing to run Breath of the Wild at a higher frame rate and stuff, but clearly you aren't buying it just to do that, or else you'd already have it. That's a nice feature alongside the other stuff you're going to do. And like, we're just not at a point where that other stuff is worth it yet. But for those who take their Switch with them on their commute every day and play all that stuff, like I'm sure it was unquestionable. Like they didn't even think about it. They just bought the upgrade and, you know, upgraded and they're good to go. And that's fantastic. It's at no point with us sharing where we're at with a given console are we trying to tell you not to buy it. We're just sharing like our thought processes and trying to provide alternative perspectives of why it's not a slam dunk, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And we're all at different stages of life, too. Like, I have no idea where Straw Hat is,
right?
Like, the age, the means to purchase and invest in a new system. Like, I, at different times, had a lot more interest in gaming and a lot more time that I could sink into it. And if it resonates, lean in, do that stuff for sure. You know, I think that's all. But I think that's. But Switch 2 versus a Steam Deck, I think that's maybe where the sticking point is. Steam Deck's pretty sick for the software prices and the capabilities that it has. I think that's all we're saying.
Yeah. The Steam Deck has the whole PC library. You could put the Switch library on it through some means, but that's mostly not fun for anyone at the moment anymore. But it has, like, I have maybe 20, and that's being generous, 20 Switch games, because I struggle so much to buy them because they're never on sale, and it's hard to justify. Whereas I have 1,400 games on Steam, many of which are perfect handheld play. So you have the beefier PC library, the cheaper games all the time. And I can just do a lot more with it. For someone who doesn't want that, who doesn't have a Steam library, it doesn't make sense. It seems like this expensive, silly thing. Frankly, I didn't get the Steam Deck when it released. And so I was a little behind on my order because when it first released, I was just like, why would I want to play my PC games on a worse PC on the couch instead of at my desk with the better PC? Like, why would I want this?
But wait a second, Epos. Yeah. Didn't playing a handheld change your life forever? Don't you need to make an entire handheld channel saying how different it is to play it on the couch
it
or to play
me,
it
man.
In the backyard?
It cured me.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, but there are, you know, sprinkles of truth in there, as there have been scenarios where, like, I've been able to play handheld stuff that I wouldn't otherwise be able to play, and having it has been nice. And it takes a little while for that stuff to click.
But before we, I might have just triggered a new comment from somebody who's like, it did change my life, idiot. I hate you, Dragoon. Look, I'm not mocking that. I understand. Handhelds are sick. It's great to get offline. It's great to get away from the setup. I totally get it. I'm mocking the YouTube meta side where
it
becomes
nonstop.
This holy grail.
Yeah.
It literally fixed my entire life.
Yeah. No, the message is to spend more time thinking like critically about your purchases. That's it. All right, you want to hit the next one?
Let's do it. Jeremy Lambright says, I want to rebuild my console and physical game collection from the original Xbox forward. What would you suggest as far as where to go? I know eBay is an option, but I've been burned there before, and I would like alternative options. I primarily play on the PC with Steam and GOG, but more and more, I feel the pull to have a physical media collection again for gaming. Epos, this is going to be 100% your category here, because I have only bought from eBay for retro and older games.
Yeah, so eBay is fine. Like, if you have a specific game that you want, like, at least a first kind of check-in to see how much it is, whether you can get it quickly or cheaply. eBay is typically pretty great for that. I don't know what experience they had to specifically be burned. But that is usually where I check first to at least get an idea of the availability of the game, of the pricing, and all that kind of stuff. When you go from there, just start looking for retro game shops. I would first pull up Google Maps or whatever you use and look if you have any game stores near you. Support your local mom and pop brick and mortar shops first. If you're looking for specific games, you're going to be hunting for a while. If you're just looking to, you know, pick up new stuff and pad out your collection, it's great to go browse them. You'd be surprised, depending on where you live. Game shops are kind of back a little bit. They're usually kind of comboed. You know, it'll be like video games and a ton of movies and board games, tabletop RPGs, and trading cards, kind of all together. But you'd be surprised. I've seen more and more pop up lately after they all, like GameStop for like 10 years, absolutely just eliminated the mom and pop game shop market, as far as I'm concerned, at least in my area. Like, they absolutely just drove them out of business. And as GameStop has become less and less relevant, those shops have actually come back up, and you know, nature is healing or whatever. If you're looking online, there's lots of, you can order from a lot of those shops online as well. So like Retro Island Gaming is one I frequent and order stuff from. That's where I got a couple of my extra copies of Pokemon from recently. East Starland is kind of a marketplace thing where people will trade in their games to them for cash, and then they'll flip them and sort through them and then sell them out. So I've ordered like big hauls from them before. There are lots of little game shops like that that you can find just a couple Google searches hunting around. But that would be where I started personally. But it goes it completely depends on what you're really hunting for. If you're looking for Holy Grails and stuff, like, you're going to be stuck in the weeds of eBay or your local shop group sales. If you're looking to just get big bulks, like bundles, start hitting up yard sales, start looking at like OfferUp or Let's Go. I think they're the same app now. I keep seeing lots of people put up like PS2, Xbox, Xbox 360 bundles for like $80 with a bunch of games with them. The Wii, same thing. So that is the way to go. If you are hunting for Nintendo games, good luck. Like, every local game shop I've gone into, they'll have a Wii and a DS section, and it's always just like the sports games or the shovelware. It's never
it's garbage.
The games you're looking for.
Yeah.
Because people just buy those up and flip them no matter what. But yeah.
Retro Island has some cool prices. I'm looking here. I didn't know it existed, but a lot of the PlayStation 2 prices for some of these things are comparable or less than what you would find on a reseller with eBay. There's just such good information. What you recommended, Retro Island Gaming.
No, that's what I got. I will always prefer to buy, like, try to buy these places first, because eBay prices can get insane. And I say to take eBay as a first reference, but then compare those to the retro shops, because often I will be like, okay, like, I was hunting for extra copies of Pokemon Gold and Silver. I pull up eBay and it's like $150, and I'm like, whew, all right, I gotta figure out how to plan for this. And then I grabbed mine from Retro Island. I think it was like $80, which is still kind of nuts, but that's just where the market's at now. But that's $80. I'm trying to pull up my receipt so I can get the exact. Yeah, $79.99 for Pokemon Silver, $78.99 for Pokemon Gold. And that is with a fresh battery and everything, too. Like, they have cleaned it up, made sure it's in good condition, and swapped the battery so it's actually playable. Whereas with eBay, who knows what you're getting.
Thankfully, the Xbox side has not really had the bump that the other games have had.
Yeah.
You know, Xbox still feels pretty easy to collect for.
It's held up pretty good. PlayStation 2 is all right. There's a lot of, like, big hitters.
It's getting more pricey.
That people are really going after. PS3 is really good right now. 360 is pretty good. So it just, like I said, it depends on what you're going for. PS1's in this really good spot where, unless you're going after like crazy Holy Grails, even some of the big cult classics are still very cheap. Like, I've picked up this past year, I've talked about on the other side of our podcast, I've gotten like Vagrant Story, Vagrant Heart, whichever one. Valiant Heart and Vagrant Story. Those mixed up. Digimon World games, a couple others. Like, I've been surprised at how easy it's been to kind of fill out my PS1 collection.
I kind of love. Yeah, I mean, Final Fantasy X is $20 on the PlayStation 2.
Yeah.
It's just wild to me how things have rotated back. You would think this would be a $2 game at this point, you know, like bargain bin stuff. That's my favorite game of all time, by the way, so I'm not talking down on it. Well, best of luck, Jeremy. Let's move on to the next one, Nightmare's Kin. I think that's I5C at the end of there.
Yeah.
Nightmare says, so I've always been a dirty console peasant because I prefer having physicals, but I'm seriously leaning towards getting a PC since my last one fried. Anyone have any suggestions? I also want to mention in regards to not wanting to play at a PC when you use one for everything else. Sounds a lot like sleep hygiene and how it's so much better for you to sleep in a separate room from where you do everything else. Makes a ton of sense. That's a great comment.
Yes.
Ooh, PC stuff right now, Epos. You've got this one dialed.
I will say yes, having separate areas for different, like, not tasks, but mindsets, like a creative area and a gaming area or a work area and your personal area. Separation of those things is hugely important for your mental health long term, especially if you work from home. But in terms of PC stuff, my brother-in-law is currently in search of a new PC as well, and it is quite the space at the moment. Tariffs and price hikes and new models, you're in for a ride. I will say NZXT and Corsair both have pretty solid, like, normal people pre-built PCs. There's a lot of bougie, like, pre-builders that'll do really artsy computers, and they're super expensive. NZXT and Corsair both have solid ones. If you're looking for, like, just a configurator to pick your parts and have them send it to you, I don't know what your experience is in terms of if you want to build or buy, but that would probably be my direction. I'd avoid the PCs listed on Amazon and stuff. Those are always kind of a mess. But specs-wise, you're looking like whatever the modern, like, Intel i5 equivalent is. I know they're going with, like, Core Ultra naming and stuff. And then, like, a RTX 3060 equivalent graphics card. That kind of tier is going to take you a long way and not cost quite as much. But prices right now are a mess. So I will say, if you can find, using one of the configurators or whatever, a baseline of what you're going for, shop around a ton. Like, screenshot it, print it out, whatever you need to do to save that spec list, and then start really comparing what every system builder you can find will do. I will say, if you live near a Micro Center, you can go up there and they will, for, like, at least the shopping help, no extra charge. If they build it, it'll cost like $30 or something. But they will walk you through and help you pick out compatible components for everything, and they will build it there for you on the spot. And I think they have pre-builds too, but, like, pretty cool experience.
They have nice bundles most of the time, yes, too. Like, usually you can get a good CPU, yeah, bundle with a cooler and a board and save some money.
Yeah, so they are, like, one of the best retailers to reliably get good prices on stuff. Newegg's kind of fallen apart in recent years.
Yeah, I will say, I encourage building. You helped me build my first PC in late 2016. And since then, I've built four for different, like, use cases and stuff like that. And the first time was incredibly intimidating. I almost went pre-built. I, like, chickened out at the 11th hour, and I'm so grateful. It really is something, if you are down to read, watch, and take a little extra time, that additional knowledge and understanding of your components in your system will give you so much more, not only appreciation, but just confidence in troubleshooting and knowing what to upgrade. And, I mean, it's hard with PC prices right now because building a fresh set of hardware is very expensive.
Yeah.
But that the software prices, if you're going to prioritize only games on seasonal deals like Steam sales, man, it's almost impossible to argue with the quality, yes, of games you can get for $5 to $10.
Yeah. If you can watch a few guides, I will say, once you understand, like, part compatibility, that's the hardest part, is making, like, you don't want to just blindly buy PC components because they might not, like, you might not have the right processor for your motherboard kind of thing. That's the main one. But then once you're building it, the only really scary part is installing the processor, because you got the tiny pins and you got to line stuff up, and it's kind of high stakes, but, like, it goes really quickly once you, like, it's like a Lego. You slot it in and then you're done, but, like, it feels super scary. The messy part is also that part, because you got to put the thermal grease on if your cooler doesn't come with it. But then otherwise, like, as long as you're free of static and you're touching your metal case enough to discharge or whatever, like, it's kind of hard to break anything. It's just maybe you didn't plug something in all the way or something. Like, the stakes get very low once you get the processor in there. And frankly, I've built house furniture that's more complex than building a computer, yeah, once you get the basic, yeah, gist of, like, think about it like a piece of furniture. Like, you have your RAM, your processor, your graphics card, and your power supply. Think about it like your chair legs and your tabletop and whatever, and then it's a lot less intimidating.
That's a great point. It's like Legos, but as long as you're down to be patient and read the instructions. I felt like after I built it for the first time, anybody can do it, and I do think that. But then there's also people who are impatient, who don't read instructions, who just rush. Yeah. So if you're that type of person, maybe pre-built's the play there. So
speaking of Lego, I think I'm probably going to include some footage for the edit of this podcast. I finished that Lego Voyagers co-op game with my kiddo. Absolutely beautiful. Super short, but it's only like $20. So if you have anyone special in your life that you'd love to share a gaming experience with, prepare to tear up a little. But Lego Voyagers is great.
Oh, man, I can't wait. I saw that trailer added to the wish list immediately.
Yeah,
so
I've been really waiting excited for it for a few months. It's super cute. Our next comment is from Paul Alex 9428. Excuse me. I feel like mainstream games stopped being made for quote-unquote fun during or shortly after the PS3 or Xbox 360 era. I know it's kind of a hot take, but just think about it. So yes and no. Like, I mean, we were there during, I worked at GameStop during the end of the PS3, Xbox 360 era, 2012-ish time frame. So, you know, right at the tail end of it. And that was, you know, the last couple years of the pre-2010s and then 2010 onward. That's when we got Day Zero on disc DLC and horse armor and all those kinds of things. I think change, a little bit of that is a little rose-tinted glasses, maybe.
Oh, I battle with this. I think about it all the time. I told you before the show started, I boot up my PlayStation 2 all the time to play a snowboarding game called SSX. And I love it, and it's a ton of fun. And the idea of a session game that you just turn on, it's fun. You can get in, no strings attached, no giant narrative experience, no long journey for you to go on. It's just literally meant for you to have fun. And there is a line. It's not just The Last of Us. Big narrative, like immersive storytelling games were being created prior to that. Yeah. But let's just, for the use case of this comment, that is an important mile marker. When this more narrative side to these larger epic adventures became pretty prevalent and developers started realizing there's an entire new segment of people who normally don't play games, who are maybe cinema viewers who are going to start playing these things. I was watching a clip from Steven Yeun from The Walking Dead and a bunch of other stuff, and he was talking about The Last of Us, I think. I could be wrong. Maybe the clip I'm mistaken on, but it was one of those larger narrative games and just talking about how incredible the performance was. And from that point on, you start to see a different direction where, like, the era you're describing when you were working at GameStop, I feel like they were making games and marketing them for enthusiasts, for gamers, for people already, like, immersed in the medium. And that net is expanding wider as you get into these more narrative, like big third person games that Sony has put a lot of stock into the last 10 years, 15 years, whatever. And I struggle with it because there's still fun to be had, but I understand the comment that he's saying. It's a different experience if you're going to like sit down, lock in and prepare to watch a 25-hour movie game, right?
Yeah.
That's different than just booting up SSX. So there's still fun to be had. I just think you have to look towards indies now because the big AAA budget is not necessarily going towards those more fun-focused games like an Astrobot. We freaking love Astrobot. I wish we got more games like that.
Yeah.
But the green light is probably going to go towards like God of War Egypt or whatever the next one will be, you know?
Yeah.
Like a 30-hour narrative cinema game.
Yeah. My question is, are we talking about the games being made for fun as the passion of making games or for fun for the player? Because like we often, like you said, we talk about the PS3 and 360 being kind of a golden era. But also that was the era from day one. Like we're talking Halo 3 and Gears of War, the era of the blockbuster game, which is 100% a big marketing kind of business thing. Like they turned it into this big marketing thing from day one with those big titles like Halo, Gears of War, even Call of Duty. Like the blockbuster video game got its idea, was born in the 360 and PS3 era. And so if we're talking about from like, because I was thinking that was kind of splintered off some of our discussions about the industry and the people who run the games industry these days being so out of the gaming world now compared to before. I would argue GameStop being made from that indie, like, fun perspective, again, for big budget games, back in the PS1 into the PS2 era. Like, Xbox 360 and PS3 were all marketing games, like, for sure. But yeah, if we're talking about for fun for the players, then yeah, there's tons of smaller games. You just got to look smaller. There's still plenty of them. We highlight them as we go. They exist. You're just not going to find them in the same franchises that maybe you found it before.
Yeah, EA being bought for $55 billion 2 weeks ago tells you all you need to know. It's a money game at the top. And so the big releases, it's ludicrous how much money the sector has now.
Yeah.
You're talking crushing every other entertainment, like media, movies and music. Like, this is the new pond where, like, super big money, like, C-suite people go to play and make a ton of money.
Yeah.
So I don't think we will probably ever see, like, that kind of era that we saw during 360 and PS3 again. But players get to vote with their wallet, buy and support the fun stuff, and tell your friends about it.
Yep. That's the only way we can come to see more of it. Either it changes the minds of the publishers who are seeing where the money is, or it just keeps funding the indies that are making them, and they just get to keep making more of them. That's the only real way.
Gosh, what did we talk about? Maybe it's going to be for the next DualCom. I don't know if we actually talked about it, but the study that showed, like, most gamers don't buy more than, like, one new game a year.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe we'll say that for the dual commentary, but I think there's this skewing that needs to be addressed where the player base of people who play games has exploded in the last 15 to 20 years. I didn't get to talk about games growing up at school. Like, it was not accepted and cool until, like, late high school when it was the Halo years. And even then, you knew the subset of people who were into games. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And now, like, everybody plays games. That's not that doesn't feel any longer like a niche. It's just a thing. Like, everybody has touched Candy Crush on their phone or something like that.
Right.
All right, next comment. The Jared Experiment says, one thing on your comments about friend groups getting older and having a hard time scheduling. My college buddies and I, every Wednesday, set as a revolving Discord call at 8. Sometimes we hop on a game together and play co-op session games like Risk of Rain 2 and Rocket League. Other times we do our own thing, gaming or otherwise, and just catch up and shoot the stuff. But it's a low-pressure thing that people can hop on if they have time, but there isn't any pressure. Just thought I'd throw it out there for people as a recommendation to stay connected to friends, especially those that are long distance. I love that idea. I think that's great.
Yeah, I think that's phenomenal. I personally, with my, like, it's harder to do that as you have more complex family scenarios. Yeah,
you can't schedule anything.
With a kid, scheduling things is harder and harder. I love the idea. Like, sentimentally, like, in high school, I would have done this 100%. As an adult, I've never been one for the, like, the body doubling thing where, like, people, like, because my Discord server used to be popping with people who would just sit in voice chat while they did stuff all day, and they seemed to love it. I have come to really value my, like, quiet solitude during my work days and stuff. And so if I get time, it's harder for me to buy into something like that versus a dedicated, like, we're gonna play this game. But, like, yeah, if you are trying to block out time with friends, fine. Like, that's what we end up doing with our D&D groups. We have, my wife and I have, like, two different D&D groups that we've tried to just, like, fuse into one as everyone's kind of run out of time. And we basically set up, like, when we can't run our normal campaigns, we just have a time slot where it's like, okay, we're going to do some sort of one shot, we're gonna play something. And whoever can show up, can, you know, is going to play. And whoever doesn't, then we'll see you in the next one. And, like, that's kind of the only way, as you get older and schedules get messier. Like, that is kind of the only way to really juggle it, unless you have really committed people with aligned schedules.
One of our other friends, Blizzard Ball, does a video game book club that I've mentioned before. And I think that's super rad. Like, they all pick a game to just focus on for the next month. And then they have, like, one Discord call where they just, like, nerd out about it and talk about that game. And so
I think I talked about doing that for the podcast. And at first I was on board, and then I realized I've gone multiple, like, months without gaming at all. And I'm like, I don't know that I'll be able to participate.
Yeah, I feel similarly. And it would have to be, like, I'm selfishly, I don't want to play something I'm not super interested in, because time is so limited, you know? I'm like, what if we picked a stupid game? But someday that would be pretty rad. But yeah, I love that idea, Jared. That's fantastic.
Next up we have, and then do you want to hit a break after this? I don't know if you...
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a great idea.
So next up we have Organization 136458. I appreciate your guys' thoughts on the Souls game, and what Epo said really resonated with me. Maybe I just want to... Oh, yeah. So they had previously left a comment asking how to kind of stick with the frustration to play a Souls game. So they said, what Epo said really resonated with me. Maybe I just want to like the game because a lot of people in my life say it's a phenomenal series, and I just couldn't get into it because I was so frustrated with it. I might not have been in the right headspace for that kind of game, and that's okay. I've been playing through a randomized Nuzlocke of Pokemon Black. Yes! And it's fantastic. I think maybe I should try it again and see how I feel, because there is a large chance that I just feel like I should like it, and that's why I'm trying to maybe force liking it. I think after Yuka Replay League comes out, I finish it. I want to give Elden Ring a chance and really pay attention to how I feel playing with it and be okay dropping it because I'm not having fun. That is exactly what I went through with Elden Ring. I was like, do I like Souls games, or do I just like the idea of them and the cultural zeitgeist of them? And I came into it with the right headspace, and I was obsessed for at least a couple weeks. Now, I had some big disruptions and couldn't come out and play it anymore for a little bit, so I have not stuck with it, but it's not, like, I will go back to it. And I totally am prepared for the fact, and I think you should be too, there may be some crazy boss with mechanics that I just can't grasp or wrap my head around or get the timings right, and if I can't beat it, like, that may be the wall I hit and I stop playing. But that means that I had fun up until that point, and it's okay to walk away when it's not fun anymore.
What's cool about Elden Ring, more so than probably any of the other Souls games, is there will always be a way for you to beat that boss. Like, there are a few brick wall bosses that you're like, oh my gosh, like, what? But there's always the opportunity to do an NPC summon, yeah. And then there's always the opportunity to do an online summon. Like, if you really need to call in the heavy artillery. Like, I think I said this in my Shadow of the Erdtree review. I absolutely had to double summon two online people to help me beat the final boss of that thing. And I have no regrets. And it still took probably 25 attempts with online people to beat that dude. It was insane at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And I understand, like, there is a journey of prestige where maybe someday a solo run would happen. But the beautiful thing about Elden Ring is, like, if you're on a roll and you're vibing, and you're like, ah, I'll come back, I'll do this boss again on New Game Plus or whatever, you can always just summon somebody online who's, like, got the build, hooks it up, and it's fun, it's unique, you know?
Yes, that has been my experience so far, even with the bosses I have beat. And if you are playing on PC, I don't remember if they mentioned it last time, there's also the... There's just a straight up seamless co-op mod if you just want a buddy. Like, if you have people in your life that are enjoying the heck out of it, they probably are really good at the game and have played it a few times. They could just run it with you and bring you alongside. Like,
that sounds super fun. Yeah. I would love to do that.
There are so many games growing up that, like, I just couldn't figure out as a kid that I just sat with someone else as they played it. And I got to experience it as best as I could. And those experiences still meant a lot to me.
Yeah. Well, why don't we take our first break?
Yeah.
And we'll be back here in just a few minutes.
Yeah. We're back. We have so many comments. It's funny because when I review the comments, like when the podcast episodes go up, I mostly just see the ones that are like praising the podcast, and I'm like, oh, people like this, or like have one specific thing. But then when we go in and like find these, I'm like, holy cow, there's so many conversations.
Yeah, everybody. Like, this is the coolest thing ever. I'm so appreciative, but I do believe we're on the front edge of something, and this community is on the front edge of something, because every one of these comments, yeah, like you said, can spin off into like 30 or 40 minutes. I don't know about you, but I'm like trying super hard this time to, like, okay, contain your responses. We want to get to as many people as possible.
Yeah. If there's anything you all want, like, a really deep dive on, we could probably do that in the party chat episode. So just let us know. Because, yeah, if it feels like we're being too blunt or like brief with responses, it's purely because we want to make sure we give everyone a chance and cover as much as we can. So we're not trying to,
yeah, we're not just being dismissive. You know, not, I feel like this intense pressure in the back of my head, like, oh my gosh, we've already got like an hour down, how is this?
Yeah. we've only responded to four comments.
Speaking of which, our next one, Maximilian Deutschland says, what changed gaming for me was simply putting more time into it. Sounds stupid, but when I left the COD gamer bubble, I took much of my free time to look left and right? Which genres are there? Which games tell unique stories? What do I want to experience in gaming the most? I found out, after trying lots of games, that I'm open to a big amount of variety, such as action-based RPGs, story-based exploration games, strategy games, shooters, and racing games. A lot more. There are many gems out there, especially games from the past, which made me fall in love with video games a second time. Even games I first have thought they wouldn't be very interesting to me. Have a nice weekend and fun with gaming. What a great comment, Epos.
Yeah. Dude, this is the light at the end of the tunnel that we've described with this whole process of ditching multiplayer. And it kind of highlights the kind of insidious effect that can happen with current multiplayer gaming, especially, but like the marketing and the time abuse, for lack of a better word, where they try to just cannibalize all of your time and attention. We kind of forget, like we've talked about before, when we grew up with PS1, PS2, demo disc, we'd play all these games that we otherwise these days would never have given a shot. And it's because we, at the time, we didn't have this formula in our head of how our gaming time should be spent. And I think the more you get back to it, the better your game experience can be.
Yeah, we mentioned it on the last show, but watching and listening about games is not the same as playing the game. It's so cool that these mediums exist now where you can do this. But don't forget, like, the joy, like, the core of it is just sitting down and playing something, right?
Yes, and I think that's another area where spending more time on the game could be done. Like, in some situations you've described before, you know, being at work, needing to fill the void, obviously that's when a lot of people watch game streams and stuff. But I have found through my handheld specifically, and I'm just talking about a basic Game Boy, not trying to do the whole Steam Deck pitch or whatever, but like there are a lot of scenarios where I can have that going, especially if you have one with suspend and stuff, where I can just quickly flip it on, or emulators on your phone, I guess. But like having those little windows where like otherwise you'd be scrolling a algorithm feed or watching a gaming video instead of gaming, like filling that with actual gaming immediately, just 100% quality of life improvement in terms of enjoying the medium itself when you're doing the thing rather than watching people talk about
exactly. All right, next comment, Epos.
Yeah, next up we got Vidya Discourse 7702. Love this podcast, relevant to your discussion about PCs and longevity. I'd love to hear your take on the 8 GB GPU discussion that's been a major focus of tech channels lately. You both took the stance that modern mid-range PCs offer incredible value, but a lot of tech channels seem to be overly pessimistic lately. So, for those listening who are unaware, there's been a pretty big controversy for the past 2-3 generations of graphics cards, because Nvidia, being the one kind of leading the pack and holding most of the market share, keeps sticking all but the highest end graphics cards with only 8 GB of memory on the graphics card. And that memory is used for your game textures, for loading things as it's running and stuff like that. So it can have huge impacts as you start reaching up to 4K high frame rate, even some ultra wide 1440p. Once you're hitting higher resolutions, your video memory becomes a pretty big factor in what kind of performance you can get on higher settings. I think the thing to consider when we're talking about mid-range PCs is that you're also targeting mid-range gaming experiences. So you're not going to take an 8 GB graphics card on an otherwise mid-range PC and target a 4K 120 or 240 hertz OLED display and have much of a great time. Now, there are DLSS and all the upscaling algorithms that can help with that a lot these days. But like, you're not going to get that. If you're targeting that, you need a high-end PC to go with that. Like, it's just the congruency of what you're targeting. But a standard 1440p gaming monitor or lower, which is still what the average is if you look at like Steam charts and things like that, those cards are not as big of a problem. I think if we want to get in the weeds of, you know, me putting my tech reviewer hat back on Epos Fox side of things, absolutely, I think it's ridiculous that we are on like 4 generations of 8 GB graphics cards. And especially as they keep getting more expensive, there seems to be little excuse for Nvidia to keep cheaping out on memory. Like, I'm 100% on board, but putting gaming chatting hat back on, talking about your personal experiences and the side of things you have control over, I don't think you should let it stop you, because you just need to cater expectations in terms of the kind of experience you're going to have in the first place.
NVIDIA is playing a different game, by the way. Like, we're lucky we're still getting cards marketed towards gamers at all. Their market cap is...
Their business model is not gaming.
Their market
cards.
Cap is $4.5 trillion. I think it's more. Like, it's been a week or two since then, and it's all this giant AI play and buzzwords and everybody going, oh, we need AI. If that AI bubble pops, dude... NVIDIA is toast. I can't remember. I'll try and find it here in a second. But the portion, I think NVIDIA is in NASDAQ, but like the portion of that sector NVIDIA occupies is so massive. It's terrifying. If anything ever happened to like nuke their gains, like an AI bubble being popped, it's going to be bad. Everybody's going to probably be moving over to AMD cards. I don't know how much AMD is publicly. Like, they're probably, what, trying to do the AI thing as well, attract the investors and like, grow that share.
They are a little bit, especially because they're in the console hardware ecosystem. Like, they just had a big announcement with Sony about their partnership for the next X number of years or whatever.
I guess it just goes down to what kind of games you're trying to play. This is the hard part about PC gaming.
Yeah.
Guess what? You can throw a ton of money right now to play the new releases on the highest end, and in about 2 or 3 years, that FOMO is going to be slapping you in the face, because that's how this sector works.
Yep.
If you're trying to chase the sickest games at like the mid-range prices, prepared to be bummed out. But if you're looking to play games like 1440p and decently optimized releases, a mid-range build is going to be insane. Now, I get it. Like, my 1080 Ti had 11 gigs of memory. I think the base 1080 Strix that I had was 8 gigs. But yeah, this is not as friendly a space for PC builders as it was 10 years ago. It is, you're looking at a lot of pricing dynamics and shifting things now where it's friggin' expensive. So I don't know. I think everybody wants to have, like I do, anytime I do an upgrade to my system, I'm like, well, I want to future-proof it as much as possible. I want to put the money in. I want it to be good. But realize within like 2 years, you're not going to be playing the next thing at the totally toppest, highest settings, because they're going to come out with some new technology.
Yeah.
It'll be RTX, which you'll need the 70 series card for, and all your 40s and 30s. Sorry. Sucks for you.
Yeah, no. There is no future proofing. You just got to focus on the best kind of experiences you want to have for now and to not overspend so you can still afford good games. But I think there's a lot of parallels to the gaming publisher scene in that PC gamers are buying PC hardware, but they're not necessarily the target market of the company's bottom lines anymore. Like you mentioned with NVIDIA, even Mac for like, you know, Mac is the creative platform still, and it's what I'm using. But like they just announced today their M5 chips, and they specifically announced it as having a 500% AI performance increase or something. And it's like, what end user of Mac desktops are caring about their AI performance?
Yeah,
no one. But like that's just where the money is, so that's what they're building for, even if it doesn't benefit you as the user expecting X thing. So you just gotta build expectations accordingly. And like I said before with the PC part shopping, just like shop around, just don't overspend, because it
I've
will
got
not
it, by
pay
the way
off.
NVIDIA is 14% of the NASDAQ. So the NASDAQ 100, it's the 100 largest non-financial stock companies,
that's
right?
Nuts.
Almost 15% is in one company. I mean, the FANGs, the Facebook or Meta, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, all those, they make up almost half of the NASDAQ. So like if they took a header, the whole thing goes down. But one company being 14%, that's just crazy. And it's like, the AI thing is a whole other discussion, so we'll save that. That has nothing to do with the show. I don't know. There's reasons why the graphics card market is so funky, and a lot of it isn't down to them building cards for gamers anymore.
Yeah, no, 100%. As an alternative way, I am having trouble navigating this Google Doc with pictures. I wish in 2025 word processors had a better way to move your text cursor.
I got the
images.
Next one.
Somehow. Somehow it's still a problem. So we had back-to-back comments about the Steam Deck, which is, I guess, a recurring theme for this episode. So we got one from Phil Gathani 1, which you can read, and I will hit the next one.
I don't think you both realize how good the handheld market is right now. Steam Deck can even run the latest God of War. Most Sony games run playable on the Steam Deck, and there are even more powerful handhelds already. I don't think I'm on the opposite side of that. I don't know what comments we would have said that indicated otherwise. So yeah, we're in solidarity with you.
Yeah, we had the other comment saying that we were hyping up Steam Deck while not hyping up the Switch too. So yeah, we're definitely there. And then Tristan Edwards 7302 said Steam Deck has been transformative for me, not having to sit in my office to play something. I was streaming Horizon Forbidden West from my office PC to the Steam Deck where I was sitting on my lounge room couch the other day. Virtually no lag. It's crazy good. Yeah, I mean, both of us are hyped on the Steam Deck. I love mine. I've never done the game streaming thing. It's just, part of it was the hassle of, like, my gaming PC for a while was on an ultra wide, so trying to game stream to a computer that isn't using ultra wide is a nightmare. It's a whole annoying thing. But part of it is just like, for me personally, I want my handheld experience to just be the handheld experience. Yeah. Like, that's why we talked about when we talked about, like, a possible PS Vita, you know, PS handheld. Like, I want the handheld versions of games like we got on the PSP and PS Vita. Like, they were bespoke experiences that played to the handheld strengths. And I think that's something that's really powerful and something that Nintendo still continues to kind of pull off in some ways. Obviously, the features like the mouse thing and whatever that kind of breaks out of the handheld room. But, like, that's the experience that I want. So the games I load up on my Steam Deck are very different than the games I play on PC.
Use case. Yeah. Using that thing for that singular use case. Yeah. You can emulate all sorts of systems on all sorts of hardware these days, but is it really going to be great? Are there, like, for me, if there's, PCSX2 is a phenomenal emulator for PlayStation 2 on the PC, but not all games work perfectly with it. SSX 3 has a feature where when you go in the air and you do tricks, it dims the music. It's got a really cool system in the engine that, like, the song itself, they have the individual stems for, and the way that you progress down the mountain, the tricks that you do, it plays stems at different times. Doesn't work on PCSX2.
Oh, cool.
So I'm sure if I dug onto a forum, somebody has patched it, and Dragoon, you fool, that's such a simple thing to fix. But I'd rather just play it on my PlayStation 2. It's right over here. Get that real deal experience. So yeah, Steam Deck seemed great. I think PC handhelds is clearly the direction that much of the industry is going to move towards. Xbox is now making their super pricey, crazy thing. It sounds like the rumor is PSX will have a SKU that is dockable, right? And has potentially some handheld stuff to it. So, yeah, it makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. I am very much not... You just put up a video really recently at the time of recording about missing the experience of having just like the one console that you were loaded up on and simplifying the experience for a lot of people, like especially that the first comment from Phil, like that is their system, and so they will play the latest God of War and everything on it, and it is that ultimate system for them, and that is phenomenal. Like, that is a huge value. I don't knock it one bit. For me personally, as someone who is scattered in my gaming experiences, I am not going to play God of War Ragnarok on the Steam Deck or Cyberpunk on the Switch 2, because the experience is going to be so compromised compared to what I have available on a full-fledged PC or on my PS5. Like, I know that it can run it. I've also seen the videos of it, and I know, and I've played similarly intense, actually far less intense games. Like my Marvel Midnight Suns game, the like little Mass Effect Persona-like game in the Marvel universe. It is something I play a lot on the Steam Deck just because it's so casual, but the experience is so garbage, and it's like a UE4 game. It might be UE5, but I think it's UE4. Like, it is as rough as it gets, and that is nowhere near as intense as something like God of War. And so it's fine, because the game doesn't need a frame rate to play. God of War does. But, like, it's fine. But, like, a big blockbuster quadruple A game like that is one I want to experience in its full glory. So since I have these other options available to me, I'm just not engaging with it there. It doesn't mean that I don't know that it's capable of it. It's just not for me. But for everyone who has it and who wants it to be their whole system, I've seen people play through all of Elden Ring on the Steam Deck. I've seen people with the new Switch 2 playing through the Dark Souls games on it and stuff. And it seems like torture to me. But like, when it's what you really want to game on, like, it is such a good value to just have everything right there locked in on that system, and you can load it up with all your plugins and your SD card games and everything. And like, I've seen people with custom launchers and all their emulators, and it looks beautiful. It's just I've really got to segment the things that I play, or I get too overwhelmed.
Very wise. Next comment, Silenced Lamb 69. I want to play a Just Cause game, but I can't start with the first one simply because I'm spoiled on current graphics, and I can't get into something new to me.
Yeah, don't play the first one.
If it's older, I have to play the newest version of something. If I like it, I'm able to play the old titles. So should I play Just Cause 3 or 4 first? This is an easy one, dude. 3. Don't even touch 4. 4 is not the vibe. Look, Just Cause 2 and 3, they are the ones you want to play. Very simply put, incredible destruction simulators. Both are great. 2 is still the preferred, I think. I know if you're like really hung up on the graphics, like the gameplay is the most fun in 2. 3 is great.
No, graphics are still great
in
2. Yeah,
if you're on PC, like, I mean, they look, what was Just Cause 2 on the 360?
Yeah, I mean, the 360 graphics are probably a little chunky, but like PC, it looks fine. Like, it could release today and I'd be like, yep, that's a fine game.
Don't
like,
touch 4. 4, it just didn't hit the right vibe. It was different. It was just different. So
it seemed that way. I think I grabbed it just to get, I don't remember if it was 3 or 4. I think it was 4 that I grabbed to get the collector's edition little, the grappling hook thing, statue thing. But I never actually played
Avalanche sent me a copy because it was 2018. See, back in 2018-19, Machinima still existed. And so I had a manager at Machinima, like, right before Warner Brothers shut him down. And so that year I tried to review, every first-person and third-person shooter. And so I remember it was fun, but at the same time it was like you'd get the key on a Thursday. And I always tried to, beat the whole game before making the video. And so I literally would just grind game all weekend long. That's what I did with Doom Eternal. And I literally, couldn't see. I think I got my Doom Eternal video out on Monday. And I'm like, I'm done. I need to go watch Teletubbies. I need to cleanse my mind. I have ripped and teared and torn, whatever. I'm done. It's too much.
Until it is done. Yes. And it is done.
All right.
Yeah. Just Cause 2 is a sandbox. I don't know that I've ever beaten a Just Cause game. They've always been the session game for me. Like, you go in and Spider-Man around and reap destruction, and then you log out for a bit.
It's very therapeutic. You just go in.
Yeah.
Have fun. If you beat it, go back and play it again. It's that snowboarding game, SSX, that I mentioned. If you beat it, you've missed the point. It's about just playing the thing forever, you know?
Yeah, I feel that about so many games. And at least the original Just Cause formula was really good for that. We got a comment from Cheerful Crop Circle, which I just love that name.
Yeah.
BBK, what are backlogs?
You know, I think about this a lot. As stupid as that sounds, right? Why do we put pressure on ourselves to finish the stuff that we've purchased? But at the same time, too, there's some deep gratitude in that. Like, I've been loading up a bunch of Blu-rays and old DVDs onto this Jellyfin server. And I know, when I have bought a film, I want to watch it. If I just buy the film and it sits on my shelf for 10 years and I never watch it, I feel like I've wasted money. Even if it's a film that's kind of mid, I do want to experience it. I want to see the art. I want to see the story. I want to see what they've made. And I feel that psychology is there and relevant for backlogs because, I mean, do we actually want to define backlog at a simple level?
Yeah, I mean, just to be safe, in case anyone doesn't really know, a backlog is just your queue, your collection of games or any form of media or even just tasks, I guess, that is still left to do that you haven't done. And perhaps it's often brought up in the context of you're doing other things instead of finishing your back to-do list. But it's basically just a big to-do list that you're neglecting.
It's a good way to put it, because it's easy to start a new project before you've wrapped up the previous project. And for me, if I have too many threads open at the same time, it creates a real sense of scatteredness in my own life. Just if my, this pattern happens all the time in my life, I will let a room get dirty, to a certain degree, until one day I hit a breaking point and I literally super clean this space. It might just be leaving a shirt out one day because I'm busy and I'm like, oh, I'll get to that tomorrow. And guess what? You don't get to it tomorrow. And then you put another shirt and then a week goes by and you're like, why are there socks on the floor? Why is this here? And it makes me rage. It messes me up. And there's something about restoring order where it's deep clean, everything's back in its place. I can breathe again. And I feel the same if I've got like,
yeah,
if you have 10 playthroughs going at once, I don't know how people do that. I don't for story games.
Yeah, no, I don't either. I regularly find myself just uninstalling a bunch of Steam games that I had installed expecting to play in a given week or month. And you just got to start over and just pick what you're going to do. And same thing, like I'd like to keep, I have my big game shelves with all my games, but I like to keep a smaller like set of games on a different shelf closer to my consoles that are like my immediate quick grab. Either games I'm always hopping in for like sessions or my 1 to 2 to maybe 3 playthroughs I'm trying to actually work on.
I was looking out the window and a cat has a huge mouse in its mouth right now. Like just, oh man. awesome. Anything else to say on the backlogs or should we bump to the next one?
No, I mean, I think we've talked about it a ton. I just think it might have been a clarifying question from...
Okay, I have one extra question that will extend this slightly. I know we're pressed on time, but is backlog guilt something you should care about? Or how should you even interact with that emotion?
I think it's a kind of complex thing because I think in some ways, no, you should not let the physical or digital media that you own put mental strain on you because that will taint the act of doing it. But you should also keep that in mind when you're making purchase decisions. Like, should you be throwing more money at a pile that you still have not combed through? And so I think you definitely got to keep that kind of stuff in mind when you're shopping, when you're considering picking up more. Like, do you need another game if you have 200 that you've been telling yourself you would play since you were 15? Like, or maybe you spend some time getting rid of some so you have more money to put towards other ones. I don't think you should let it weigh you down and make you feel guilty because then you're just never going to play.
Yep. But it's like this balance of being intentional but not overthinking. That's a really hard line to walk. So, alrighty, our next one, Pike 27. One caveat about the AAA is dead idea is that the Japanese publishers. In general, their games are incredible. Capcom, Atlas, Square Enix, they normally release bangers. I feel Western AAA is what is out of touch with the gaming community. Feels like a cultural difference. Yeah, I fully agree with that. Persona 5, I just finished Final Fantasy 7 Rebirth. I started Remake. Capcom has just crushed it the last probably like 7 to 8 years. They are making sick video games with new tech and just awesome stuff. Like, I fully agree with that. If you're like bored of AAA or that concept, I would agree. Japan has been putting out such sick games lately.
Yeah, I definitely think it comes down to like cultural economic differences. I mean, America is where a lot of modern AAA publishers are from, like based these days, and America is much more capitalist gain driven than Japan is, especially in terms of like regulation of major corporations and all that stuff. There are a lot more rules for companies to protect the consumers and all that stuff in Japan. And also, like, our games market came from Japan. Like, we want to talk about like prehistoric tracking of like our games came from Japan, made video games for the most part, and we're like, whoa, what? And started importing them. And then we started making our own. And then we started milking them for money. So, like, it's a natural Americanized evolution for sure. And so, yeah, the American company, or sorry, the Japanese companies have stayed kind of samey. Like, even Nintendo, as much as we're critical of the pricing structures, like, their overall releases and handling as a publisher has been mostly the same. Like, they're just more expensive now. So 100% right. Like, those studios are constantly doing great and aren't beholden to shareholders and VC funding and all the weird stuff in the States that a lot of the other AAA publishers are based on. But also, those games are, they're only a chunk of the market.
I'll send you this article. It's not definitive, but I just looked up, you know, top 10 games last 10 years, right? And I'm going to read the quick list. Number 10, Hogwarts Legacy. I don't know what studio developed that. I guess WB. What? And I don't know if they're located. I think, obviously, WB's out in Hollywood.
Oh,
so.
Avalanche.
Oh, it's Avalanche. No way. Speaking of Just Cause, they developed that? I had no idea. Monster Hunter World, Capcom. Final Fantasy VII Remake, Square Enix. Cyberpunk 2077, CD Projekt Red.
And that's a Polish-based studio.
Automata, Japan. Elden Ring, Japan. Persona 5, Atlas.
Japan.
Tears of the Kingdom, Nintendo, Japan. The Witcher 3, Polish.
Witcher, which is
Baldur's Gate 3.
Portland.
Larian.
Oh,
yes.
Man.
So, I don't see any Western studios in there. Avalanche is France, right? Let me see where they're based out of. Swedish.
They are Swedish.
No way. Well, now they say they're based out of Salt Lake City on WB's website. Well, it's hard because everybody gets bought and moved and shifted and stuff like that. Anyway, I thought that was an interesting mini live anecdote there.
And then you jump to, say, Expedition 33, French.
I've been listening to the boss music again.
Like,
it's probably the best boss music theme I've ever heard in my life. And if people have played it, they know.
Yeah. So. Obviously, definitions of the West can vary, but like in terms of at least North American based, they are far and few between in terms of the heavy hitters.
Go play the good stuff. There's more good stuff out there than you have time to play. I can guarantee that. So why don't we?
Yeah. Next up, we got Disco Moon 22. I love video games, and I always will. Throughout my life, I've always tried to look at all the positive impact it could have on people. But at what point does one ask themselves, am I supposed to be playing games as much as I am? Maybe it's bad for me. The amount I'm playing or want to play may be too much. When does it start to be negative? I don't play video games every day. I work 4 to 5 days a week for 10 plus hours a shift. I can only play on my days off, but I'm always thinking about them. I feel bad when I can't play, but I feel excited when the opportunity to play is getting closer. I guess my point in question is, would my quality of life improve if I didn't expect so much from my hobby and potentially let go of it completely or let go of some of it?
Oh my gosh, what a great question.
That's heavy.
Oh my gosh, there's so much depth there.
Yeah.
Woo! Oh.
I will say, by just the very fact that you're thinking about this and asking it, you're probably in a much better place than a lot of people, because most people don't question it and play way more than you do.
See, we battle with this a lot, okay? Because I am always thinking, is this a good use of my time? Does this help me? Does this progress me? Like, I could be doing more work right now. I could be putting more effort. I could go make eight videos a week, Epos, and that'll improve my craft. And I super battle with the voice in my head about relaxing. And I've had a really, really hard time guilt-free relaxing for probably 7 or 8 years. And I imagine you're similar. There's always that little thought in your head going, I have projects I need to be working on. There's so much more I could be doing. And
that voice in my head ruined gaming for me for a while. And I had to come back to it.
I've had that thought this year a lot because I've put a ton of effort into mountain biking. And getting up at, like in the summer, getting up at 5 a.m. to get on the trail at 6 before work starts at 8. And it's a ton of time. It's a ton of effort. And I'm like, is this worth it? Like, yeah, it's good for me physically, but I'm putting a ton of time and energy into this thing. And gaming is different, obviously, because there's not necessarily that physical component involved. And this is what, it's like such a hard question to answer. Because, yeah, there probably are much more enriching ways to spend my time and more enriching hobbies, and I could read 200 books a year and get super smart, and I could have been practicing piano and doing all this stuff. But then I worry, like, am I just straight up optimizing the joy and fun out of life? Am I min-maxing my life?
Yeah, like, we need downtime, we need leisure time, we need playtime. Like, we need that as human beings. And especially for someone who seems to work a ton based on that comment, you need a lot of recharge time with that. And there's nothing wrong with that. Now, I will say we have both have found a lot of extra enrichment in life by diversifying hobbies a little bit. And that has in turn also made us enjoy gaming a little bit more. But not everybody has all that varied interest. Like, I'm someone with my rampant ADHD bouncing off the walls. I pick up a new hobby every week. Like, I am constantly interested in new things, and it makes it hard to actually enjoy anything because I'm, you know, paper thin and not super deep with a lot of things. But that juggling hobbies is my hobby in many ways, and I enjoy that. But for a lot of people, they only have the one or two things. And of course, like, when it's coming up time to play games, you're excited for it because it's not work. It's the thing you're having fun with. I think I don't think that should be the downside. I think if it's disrupting your capacity to do your daily life, that is the point where you should start getting concerned. Like, it's not, oh, it's almost the weekend, I'm going to game with the boys, I'm so excited. Like, that's not a problem. Everyone does that. If it wasn't video games, it'd be, what, sports and drinking or what? Like, most people do something like that every day, and gaming is arguably a less harmful one depending on your involvement with it. But if, like, you can't focus at work and are making mistakes and harming your job or affecting other people because you're just, like, scrolling game forums or videos or something because you can't stop thinking about it, or you can't maintain relationships because all you can think about is games, or all you can talk about is games, or you're too one-dimensional as a result of gaming too much, then, like, yeah, that's when you start looking at self-improvement things or therapy. But, like, when you work your butt off for 40, 50 hours a week with very long days, of course you're going to be excited for your thing you do on your day off. I mean, heck, even on my days where, like, I literally play games for my job in a way, I look forward to then going and cooking and, like, getting to craft my fun pasta experiment of the week, or going out for a hike and taking photos. Like, I'm really excited the more that comes up and I start getting my little photography bag together or whatever. Like, that's normal. I don't think anyone who has a day job, especially one that seems that intense and limits their gaming around that, really has anywhere to be concerned, unless you are feeling like, are you feeling something is lacking in your life? Are you feeling that you're missing out on something or that something is being hurt because of your investment in games? If so, then that's time to evaluate that. But if you're just asking because you do a thing, and you've probably heard too many voices of all the moral panic about games are bad and corrupt your brain.
This speaks so personally because a year and a half ago, I've told the story 800 times, so everybody who's heard it, I'm sorry, but I stopped playing multiplayer games. And this channel and my interest in gaming for like 13 years was straight up very multiplayer focused from Halo onward, like Halo 2, Halo 3 onward. I did play single player games during those years, but just not as much. And literally, it was not fun anymore. I didn't stop for some stoic monastic dream or philosophical goal. I just recognized my time is limited and I am not having fun playing this stuff. Why am I playing it? And so you, at the end of the first paragraph, you say, when does it start to be negative? It started to be negative when I stopped having fun, when it stopped recharging me, when it was this weird mental obligation where I would just get on to play ranked Halo Infinite because I wanted to just, I guess, push that rank up. I wasn't having fun. And so I think if I had continued to keep playing stuff that was making me miserable, not recharging, not refueling, then that would have been very negative. And I love what you highlight, Epos. The concept of the feelings test extends beyond just the realm of like a media that you're consuming. If you're feeling like this pull or desire, like something is missing in that day-to-day life, and you're filling distractions up instead of taking steps towards what that next thing potentially could be, your level of awareness of it, Disco, I think you're in the clear. The fact that you're listening to yourself and you're being intentional to this degree so far, I doubt you're going to get into a rut where you're just stuck and you're distracting yourself and not moving forward in life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
A great comment. That was a really good comment.
All right. Yeah, for sure.
I think we hit the end of the document, dude.
Oh.
I think we hit
do
the
it?
End of the, yeah.
I didn't think we'd be able to do it.
Right. Holy on.
All right. There's definitely more comments to screenshot for future episodes, but that wrapped up perfectly. Okay. What a deep comment to end on.
It's heavy. It's heavy, like you said. So.
Yeah.
But wait, one last thing. It is okay. Not only is it okay, you have to recharge the batteries. Like,
yes.
If you run your engine on red too long, your body gives out. Something gives, and it usually is like in a bad physical way. So just, it is okay to recharge and relax. I still have to remind myself, it's cool. You got to put that time in, because if you're just an athlete who's always training, never resting, you're going to run yourself into the ground and not be the best person you can be. So balance. It's a balance.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. I even had to have that conversation with my wife yesterday because I only had a couple work days last week while my kiddo was on fall break. And then Monday, I hit the ground running hard, made a made channel video, scripted into the voiceover for a gaming video, wound up editing it that night. Like, I was already two videos in, which is often all I get done in a whole week. And then I knew today I've got the podcast and then got a couple other things scheduled for the day. And so yesterday I was really struggling because my wife and I wound up just like going out for a brunch date and shopping. And then I wanted to spend the rest of the time before kiddo got out of school just like relaxing and playing my Game Boy. But that just felt wrong. It was like, it's a work day. I'm so desperate for work days. Tomorrow I'm going on a field trip. Like, I'm so desperate for work days. I'm going to be really bummed if I miss out on it. And I just had a whole week off basically. But like, I still, when I'm having these intense days, it benefits me to just recharge. And so I got to spend an extra hour or two during the day just playing Pokemon and taking a brief nap. And that is okay. Like, as long as you aren't hurting anyone, like, it's fine.
I'm feeling that flat as a piece of paper right now because the last 2 weeks of real work has just been gnarly. And usually this is the time of year where things kind of slow down. And it does. I've got another 5 weeks of just jamming. And so until Thanksgiving, it's going to be rolling. And I know for a fact, if I can get about 20 minutes to 30 minutes on this PlayStation 2, like no interruptions, no distractions, snowboarding down the hill, I get to be the best version of myself because I'm refilling with something. I know getting out on the mountain bike makes me a much better person. Like, I internalize so much stress and frustration and just stuff it down. And when I get on the bike or exercise, it just works its way out. I don't know how. It's this like magical thing. And so I know I become a much chiller, calmer, nicer person, like less edgy if I'm working out, getting outside, doing that kind of thing, fresh air, whatever. And so it's all balance. If I blew off all responsibilities to sit there and play PlayStation all day for 6 hours a day, not only will it stop being fun, I can guarantee you that, but then it is disruptive, then it is negative, and then it can stall you.
Yeah. 100%.
Most excellent. All right. Epos, thank you for another episode. I'm used to the dual con outro. I'm like, where can people find your content? Well, they're finding your content right here on Lost Saves.
So where can people find your content,
Mr. Dragoon? I am on BBK Dragoon, and I upload mountain bike videos at BBKMTB. Help me get to 1,000 subscribers. We're at like 850 or something like that. Only if you like biking. Don't just sub to sub. But I'm trying to take a similar approach there and just talk from the heart and not necessarily be like, here are the top 6 trails that you need to do to improve your footwork while on the bike. So anyway. Thanks everybody for listening. Thanks for being a part of this incredible community. You can follow this podcast on all your favorite podcast platforms. Links will be in the description below. And if you haven't heard our main show, the Dual Commentary Podcast, the links to that will be down below and also on the podcast platforms as well. So thanks so much.
Yes. Thank you. You did all my work for me today.
Have a good one. And we'll see you in episode 3.
See you.